You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
Hello, Majority Report listeners. Producer Matt Binder here. And you might be wondering why you're hearing my voice at the top of the show. Well, in the members' half today, a caller, Cindy, gave us a ring and she explained why she became a member of the Majority Report. And it was such a stunningly awesome endorsement of becoming a member of the show that we felt that you freebie listeners should listen to it. All right, enjoy.
Cindy from San Diego. Welcome to the program, Cindy.
Hey, thank you. Sam, I just wanted to tell you I just joined your show.
Hold on for a second.
You remember?
Thank you, Cindy.
And these are the reasons why I did it. I've been listening now for over a couple of weeks, and I wanted to make a conscious decision whether it was really a good show. And I have to honestly tell you, you are excellent. Excellent. You hit every single point. You're very well-versed because I watch all the TV programs, all the news channels, and, man, you are spot on. I just want to tell you, it's well worth the money. I really look forward every morning to listening to you. I get up early so I can log on my computer, and I'll tell you, it's money well spent. So I urge everybody who's sitting on the fence about joining, it's well worth the money. We need more people like you.
Thank you, Cindy.
I just want to say thank you.
That is very, very sweet of you. I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on board. Where'd you hear about the show?
I've been watching you for a while. I've seen you on MSNBC. I listened to Majority Report before that, Air America. But I got it the way I found out you were on is you sent me an email.
Ah.
So that's a good way to communicate because I didn't even know. And then one day I got the email, I logged on, and I've been listening ever since, so I decided to join.
Well, thank you again.
Well worth the money.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Keep doing what you're doing. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, we should maybe put that on in the front. Maybe we should put that right up top.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday, Tuesday, Casual Tuesday, Wednesday, Casual Hump Day, Thursday, Casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 16th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, because it's Casual Friday, Cliff Schechter. Or as we call him around here, Fiscal Cliff Schechter. Also on the program to give us a movie selection for the weekend, my old friend, Mark Maron. My understanding of how it's pronounced. But before we go to Cliff Schechter... Oh, folks, let me remind you, it is your membership that supports this program. So your membership is desperately required. We need to upgrade the guy who works the board so you can get those musical ramps going.
My bad.
You can join the show. You can support the program. Even if you just listen on Fridays, folks, still a great deal. $2 a show, $2.25 a show. Are you kidding me? to hear the great wisdom of Cliff Schechter and the maybe less so of someone like Marc Maron.
For the just unparalleled political analysis every Friday, wrapping everything up.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Michael. We could use a little work on the marketing.
How much is the show per day?
Well, the show per day is less than 30 cents, but I'm saying if you only listen on Fridays.
What a deal.
It's like $2.50. Wow. Wow. That's a coffee. If you're lucky these days. So now it's time for Cliff Schechter, but of course, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back with the Cliff Schechter theme song.
Libertas LLC, new media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Fiscal Cliff Schechter.
Sam.
Hello, Cliff. You know, today, it's not today, actually. It's tomorrow, technically. But tomorrow is our two-year anniversary.
Oh, my God.
I can't.
Congratulations, pal.
Well, thank you very much.
It's like you gave birth to this thing.
Yeah.
And it's grown into its own mature, adult-like self, spread out its tentacles, and really just gone and taking the world on by storm, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that it was actually born, fully formed, and now has just been stagnant for 2 years. That's another way.
Maybe a Benjamin Button kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we have now served over, well over 2.5 million podcasts. At least of our free podcasts, 2.5 million podcasts in 2 years. That's pretty good.
Hey, you know what I mean? You guys in McDonald's doing lots of serving.
Yeah, that's a lot of 2.5 million, I should say, downloads. We actually haven't done 2.5 million shows. That would be a lot of shows to do.
I would be even more impressed than I already am if you had done that many shows.
Yeah, that would be pretty. That would justify why I feel so exhausted, but not the case. 2.5 million downloads. We're probably closer to about 2.7, 2.8. I haven't done the work because we don't have as accurate numbers on our members feed. But
what happens when we unskew what you just said? What will we come up with?
Yeah, five. We've had five downloads.
I'm just kidding. Seriously, congrats. That's good stuff.
Oh,
that's great
you.
Stuff.
Thank you, Cliff, and I appreciate your work on this program. You show up every Friday, and people love it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad they do. I love it. I enjoy it. It's a great part of my Friday. So,
all right. Well, this has been a great segment, and this is why people keep coming back.
That and the big paycheck are what got me here.
Yeah. All right. Well, putting that paycheck aside for a moment. So we are now into the second Obama administration. He had a brief, I think, two-day honeymoon. He came out, gave his first press conference of his second term. And let's start with the grand bargain and the taking your name in vain with this fiscal cliff thing.
I got to say, that really offends me.
I doubt it. There's a lot.
I feel like somebody, you know, like you had your own name, and then a serial killer comes along with the same name.
Yeah,
it's never the same. It's kind of like that.
Tell me about it, Son of Sam, and it's the son of Sam, not even Sam. And as a kid, I still got a lot of grief about that. But all right, first off, the amazing thing is, and you know. I've talked about it a little bit this past week. We had a budget analyst on the program yesterday. But the fiscal cliff, when you think about the two things that are being, there's really three things that are floating in the ether. The fiscal cliff, the grand bargain, and Simpson Bowles, that letter written by those two old guys who hate Social Security. And
right.
The irony is, or maybe not the irony, or the purpose of this, I think the conflation of these things is not on purpose. Simpson Bowles does exactly the opposite of what you want to do if you take the fiscal cliff seriously. In other words, the fiscal cliff is better described as, I think Krugman mentioned today and Brian Beutler coined the phrase, as an austerity bomb, which will sink the economy, because it provides all sorts of cuts for services and all sorts. It takes government spending and reduces it. Now, let's not get into the specifics of how we reduce it, but as a baseline, it reduces government spending. It increases taxes on everybody, particularly particularly in terms of austerity. It has more impact for basically the bottom 98%, because they spend that money as opposed to going and invest it in the Cayman Islands or whatever it is.
Right.
The reason why people are worried about this is because it sinks the economy. At the same time, people are talking about Simpson Bowles and deficit reduction, which is the same thing. They are also an austerity bomb. It's almost just like pick your flavor, but they're spoken about as if they are an antidote, or maybe I'm mixing metaphors here, but a bridge for the fiscal cliff, when in fact, no, they represent a fiscal cliff. Cliff?
My name, so well used. I mean, obviously that's exactly right, that analysis. And again, sort of speaks of the ridiculous situation we're in, where we've learned nothing from history, even our own recent history, for that matter, but certainly depressions past, and looking over across the pond to Europe and what they've done, and you know, Simpson Bowles and cuts to needed spending are just about the dumbest thing you could do. I also find it interesting that people on the right, or let's call them, you know, especially the corporate right, are always talking about the confidence fairy, you know, that if businesses don't have confidence, they won't invest. And what if people don't have confidence and they think you're going to come take their money away? You think they'll spend more? I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. It really, in every way, it's idiotic. And obviously, it doesn't even get to the point of, you know, we go through these things periodically. We went through a period of time where the budget, the deficits and our debt overall were going to kill us. Remember that little funny guy, Ross Perot, back in the early 90s?
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Clinton at that point, you know, stepped up and did some things I disagree with too, but they eventually balanced the budget, and guess what he did? He raised taxes on top earners, and they were able to balance the budget, which a Republican president then just came in and immediately undid, which is exactly what will happen here. I mean, all this stuff it's a big game, you know, cut, you know, we'll fix things and we'll have the budget in balance. And really what these guys want to do, of course, is cut Social Security, Medicare, and social programs, and then we get to balance that way. And eventually, of course, a Republican president comes in, God help us, but one will eventually come in again, and we'll just cut taxes further.
Yeah,
because that's really just a long-term plan again and again and again.
The interesting thing is that, you know, we spoke at the beginning of the week to David Graeber, who wrote that fantastic book about debt. And, you know, this week, obviously, the debt jubilee is taking place, and there is, you know, more than it having an impact. I mean, it'll have an impact on some people, but in terms of the economy at large, the greater impact is more sort of the political conversation around it. But if you look at, and he seems to, you know, he said basically, you know, all of these, many of these arguments, he wasn't talking specifically about our fiscal situation, but more about the economy, more just about the way that our policies have run amok, you know, can be boiled down to debt. And if you look at the Bush tax cuts as essentially providing a loan to people. Because, I mean, we all knew there was a reason why these things were set to sunset, right? We knew that it was unsustainable. You can't right. cut taxes that much. It was a loan. And essentially, and in fact, in the case of Social Security, it was literally a loan, $2.5 trillion and growing in the Social Security Trust Fund. But that is, you know, people say, well, it's just IOUs. Okay, so it was a loan to the U.S. government to finance the cutting of taxes for the wealthy. And now, essentially, what the wealthy are saying is we want, essentially, to have that loan forgiven. We want right. to get out of that obligation of paying those dues, paying what we owe, whether it's paying it back to the Social Security Trust Fund by cutting Social Security or cutting back on Medicare or poverty programs or the functioning of the government. We just want that debt forgiveness, essentially, and we want other people to eat that failed loan, essentially. And it is being presented in the corporate media as if this is the most responsible way forward. We gave tax cuts to the wealthy, and now we can't pay for feeding kids, poor kids, school lunch. And so they're literally just going to have to eat it. And they're going to have right. to eat the fact that we took this loan out.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And again, like, I can forgive anybody who's 25 years old or younger who wasn't alive and or at least, you know, paying attention to this stuff when it was going on in the early to mid-90s, particularly during, you know, when Ross Perot freaked out constantly about it. But, if you've been here before, which most people in the media outside of, let's say, Luke Russert, genius that he is, who've been here and seen these things before, then either they just don't care about the truth and don't really – you know, want to get to it, or they're outright lying, because we've all been through this stuff before, and we saw what happened. Because, you know, the world was going to come to an end the last time we were running these deficits. Remember, deficits created by who? Ronald Reagan and Reaganomics, which was this period before when we gave huge tax cuts to the rich, essentially loaned them that money, as you're saying, and then came back and said, well, now we've got to, you know, now the Republicans came back and essentially wanted to take it away from everybody who was poor. And to his credit at the time, Bill Clinton stood up and we raised taxes on top earners, and there are also some cuts that shouldn't have been made.
Right.
And we did that, and the budget was balanced just in time for another Republican president to come in and do exactly the same thing. And so it just becomes so utterly ridiculous that you really have to be sort of bereft of all historical knowledge, or just someone who's a serial fabricator, to not just, especially if your job as someone in the media is to understand these things and explain them and I don't know, perhaps tell people the truth so they can make well-informed decisions, which is what I thought their role was in a democracy. And they're not, of course. They're at, you know, again, there's this hysteria that the world's coming to an end, that we can't fix this thing unless we cut X, Y, and Z. We can fix this thing. It can be fixed very easily. It really isn't a big deal. We're just making it a big deal so that we can, you know, hit up Medicare and Social Security, we can raise taxes on top earners, we can cut spending from a whole bunch of places where spending should actually be cut from, like $100 billion plus from defense. It's that, you know, a lot of money that the generals don't even want. I think two states came out pretty strongly. I think a third one, Massachusetts, on the medicinal side, and said make marijuana legal. You know, I mean, why don't we start a baseline analysis of all the freaking money we're wasting on this idiotic drug war, which nobody wants.
Not to mention the money that we're leaving on the table in terms of sales tax on it.
That's right. It's money that we could make off of taxing marijuana, but also in terms of how much money is being spent by the criminal justice system on housing people, on court time, on police time, on this stuff. How much money is being spent due to the violence that's created by it in our healthcare system? How much money is being spent in lost productivity because of people we're locking up and then throwing them out into the world and saying, okay, now you're a felon, good luck. It's just, it's so utterly stupid. And so to sit here and have this and then be like, well, what we really need to do is we need to cut money from poor people because of all these stupid policy decisions we've made over the last 30 years, most of which can be undone very simply. Is ridiculous.
All right,
that's really what people need to understand.
President Obama gave his first press conference, and As far as I could tell, as far memory serves me correctly, he mentioned entitlements only once and immediately followed it up with a reference to spiraling healthcare costs. So, and we know that this is the biggest challenge that that we have or at least the government has in terms of a fiscal challenge, is the rising costs of healthcare. Now, this is unrelated to what the government does in the context of healthcare in terms of Medicare, let's say, or Medicaid, because we know that the growth of medical services in both those programs is slower than in the medicine that is paid for by private insurance. So
much lower overhead because they are much more efficient.
And the administrative costs are cheaper, but they also manage to keep the actual costs of providing care. They keep it the rate of growth slowed because they have more cost controls.
And if we would unshackle them even further and do what every other industrialized country does and say that that we're going to give our federal government the power, you know, to negotiate drug prices,
right?
Bulk negotiate, then the price that the government has to pay for those drugs that end up, you know, going to people and costing us more money too, would also come down. So there's artificial ways that we're actually still, of course, paying more money. Our government is, and our people are, than is necessary. We're essentially paying for the R&D for the rest of the world, and that's utterly ridiculous too. Another way you could easily cut, you could have another cost control when it comes to spending. Not to mention reimportation of drugs and other things like that that would force the drug prices to come down.
So you work with Social Security advocacy groups. What is the sense? I mean, we've seen now Harry Reid come out and say not on the table. We've seen Elizabeth Warren come out and say Social Security should not be on the table. There seems to be more. Obviously, we've talked about this in the past, but we have a more liberal Senate in some respects. I mean, not dramatically so, but at least we have a larger liberal, genuinely liberal caucus within the Democratic caucus in the Senate.
And in the House, for that matter.
And in the House. But
we picked up House seats, and a number of those seats we picked up. Yeah, there was a blue dog here and there. I don't even know if there was a blue dog. Let's say there was a new Dem here and there. But I worked on, I worked with a super PAC, Friends of Democracy, and we, ended up picking up 11 of the 14 seats that we targeted, and they were all like super, super progressive Democrats.
So let me ask you, what are the Social Security advocacy groups saying? Are they encouraged, at least in terms of Social Security? Because I think my sense is, anyways, that there is a diminished appetite to put Social Security on the table. And I say that simply because of both what we're hearing out of the Democratic caucus and also what we're reading from people like Matt Bai, who seem to have a mild state of panic that in some way Social Security won't be cut.
He's freaking out.
And so what is your sense, and what are people saying about Medicare that you're hearing?
Actually, right now, and I never, ever, ever in this game will get overconfident about anything. But I'm feeling better than I have, ever when it comes to this since I've been involved in this fight, which is, a while now. You've got great state, President Obama felt compelled to, whether he felt compelled to or just wanted to, obviously had a meeting with a number of progressive organizations. And it was some pretty independent minded ones. It wasn't as much as what occurred during the first Obama election when a lot of these groups were just sort of dismissed and called crazy leftists by the likes of Rahm Emanuel. And you've had you've had a number of leaders, as you just pointed out, important leaders. Harry Reid and is obviously that's hugely important. Some of the newly elected members, you've had Bernie Sanders is out there and being very vocal about this and saying no way. And you've got people signing on to this letter, which I think is going to expand. And so I would never get to the point where I would say,
the fight's done. I mean, this is going to be a long fight. I mean, not long as much as it's going to be tough. But right now, I would say that, you know, the credit was given when a deal was averted last time to sort of Tea Party Republicans who, you know, wouldn't raise any tax, anything. And I think now you've got liberal Democrats who are just as adamant about not cutting Social Security and not raising the eligibility age for Medicare. And these were ideas that were in the mix, you know, when President Obama met with Boehner last summer. And now you've got a lot of people very vocally, both, you know, movement-oriented folks, elected officials, progressive pundits who are drawing a line in the sand and reminding President Obama the coalition of people that got him elected, and how even more so than the general public, which overwhelmingly does not want these programs cut, even more so this growing coalition that elected President Obama and frankly elected plus two, you know, in the Senate and plus seven in the House does not want this done. I would say right now we're making some progress. Let's put it that way. And everybody still needs to get out there and make their voices heard and write their congressman and write their senator, particularly the ones who are, you know, those who are seem to be on the corporate sellout committee. You know, the first one in that is Mark Warner, you know, of Virginia, who I think wants to run for president. So I think people might want to remind him, if he even has an inkling of a thought of wanting to run for president, he'd better step away from any cuts right now, or we will actively oppose him.
Now,
go ahead.
Mark Begich of Alaska has proposed basically not only taking Social Security off the table, but also has proposed lifting the cap on high income contributions. He's It basically says the current law sets cap at 113. It hasn't gotten much attention. I guess he made this proposal 2 days ago now, which is good that we're seeing this, you know, in the mix. I think it's important to have this in the mix. Now, this if you were to raise the cap, and, you know, he's suggesting, I guess, do it over 7 years and lift it totally, it would extend Social Security for about 75 years, because really it's almost impossible to sort of project beyond that, because we don't know. You can't, I mean, demographically speaking, it's a little bit hard to project, but
right.
75 years out, 100% benefits. I actually think that I've seen some studies which show that if you were to lift the cap, you could actually expand Social Security benefits, which I think certainly we should be doing right now. One of the big things that people aren't talking about is the ending of the Social Security tax holiday, which diminishes payments by 2% on the employer and employee side.
Right.
Where are you on that? I mean, my personal feeling is that there's a lot of other ways to provide that if we need that stimulus, there's a lot of other ways to provide it. I don't know if there's other ways politically to provide it, but certainly I'd like to see the attempt, because I don't like the rhetorical or the optics involved in Social Security having to have its revenue shortfall because of this holiday made up by the general fund. If we're going to make it up by the general fund, let's just make it up by the general fund, have the general fund, provide more tax cuts for, you know, like a make work pay type of tax credit type of situation.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. And that's the thing, because it's easy to be torn on that, because you want people to, I don't want to raise taxes. I don't want to take money away from people that actually really need it right now. And at the same time, obviously, when you start taking money out of Social Security, that can become a dangerous trend. I obviously would like to see us, you know, find a way to provide those tax credits to people through more traditional means, let's say. It may be harder with the Boehner House there. But, you know, I think I'll say this, you know, and tell me what you think, Sam, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, but it's not just that Harry Reid and others have come out and been more forceful. I have to give, you know, credit where it's due. I mean, President Obama on a number of things has come out and been more forceful. I think I've seen him, you know, attack the GOPers, particularly when they went after Susan Rice, for example, and when they're on their tax position, he came out and came out with a number, $1.6 trillion. I'll just say that at least now I see Democrats coming out in an offensive position like I always expected after the last election. And so that gives them a place to bargain from, as opposed to starting off two-thirds of the way towards the other side and starting off in a position of weakness. So, that would be, I mean, my preference would be to expand ways of getting people tax credits and other things who are lower and middle income through obviously the income tax and other things.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I think, well, it certainly looks like they're being more aggressive. And, you know, Mike Lux had a piece up who was an open lefter at one point. He has some connections in sort of the more progressive end of the spectrum within the administration. And he says that at the very least, the administration is positioning themselves to be more partisan and, you know, more supportive of a Democrat, taking a more Democratic, more partisan posture, which is, you know, helpful as far as that goes. I mean, it's certainly better than one saying that we want to be the grown-ups in the room who are in the middle in some way.
Right.
That fantastic.
All that is a recipe for what occurred.
Once bitten, twice shy, though, is what I've been saying to myself. Now, I'm not 100% sure I know what that means, but I think
what have you been saying to yourself?
Once bitten, twice shy. Do I have that right?
Oh.
Where you get where you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, type of thing.
Won't be fooled again.
Won't be fooled again. Mission accomplished.
Now I've got the song "Once Bitten, Twice Shy" in my head, and it's all your fault.
I understand, but I mean that's sort of the posture I'm taking. But so far we've seen it. We've certainly seen him, like the whole thing with McCain. Now there's nobody to talk about the real John McCain. Nobody better to talk about the real John McCain than the author of the real John McCain. And of course, I'm talking about you, Cliff Schechter. The author of the real John McCain.
One of the few people dumb enough to bury themselves in notes and research and interviews about John McCain over the course of a year. And I think I'm still scarred a little bit mentally from it.
Has there ever been a – I mean, I guess Bob Dole, when he lost in 96, he still had some relevance, but it wasn't I think – I don't. You know, has anybody lost the – well, I guess Joe Biden – but no. Has anybody lost the presidency – and then still retained as much relevance in the eyes of the press as John McCain has?
Not in the modern era, no. I mean, you know, there are guys that lost the presidency, and even in landslides, and eventually and they ran, either they were still in the Senate or ran for their Senate seats and came back, like McGovern and Goldwater, you know, who are still even a part of the conversation. But this guy lost in a landslide, and it just speaks to the enduring power of building that beautiful, you know, I'm a nonpartisan, independent thinking, centrist brand in Washington, D.C. Because the dude not only stepped completely away from everything he claimed to stand for and showed himself for the partisan hack that he was, but got smoked in that election. And yet he still has a warm seat for him on Meet the Press or Face the Nation really anytime he wants. He was completely wrong about the Iraq War and most other things, but deadly wrong about the Iraq War. And I'll just, you know, reiterate, I put this up on my Facebook page the other day. I think I tweeted it out, which was the conclusion that I wrote in The Real McCain. And I think it's a pretty easy conclusion to come to. Before, you know, I predicted he'd behave like this if he lost, which he has now for the entire term, which is, you know, or Obama's entire first term and now into the second term, which is, John McCain is somebody who literally is completely controlled by his anger and bitterness. That's all he is. So he doesn't legislate based on anything, for the most part, I mean, there's a little exceptions where he does stuff because he can get press love out of it, but for the most part, has legislated by who he's angry at. And you can look, after that 2000 election, when he was mad at President Bush, he didn't sign on to suddenly to close the gun show loophole and to oppose President Bush's tax cut and to stand up with Teddy Kennedy and argue for a patient's bill of rights because he actually gave a crap about any of that stuff. He did it because he hated Bush.
Right.
You know, he was trying to go after Bush. And he kept doing that all the way through 2004 to the point where he determined, maybe I could be president and run again in 2008 and I'm going to need the Bush people's help. And decided that and then he went far to the right. I mean, literally, there was a point in time there, I used to have this analysis in front of me and I don't now, where he was either the second or third most, and I put this word in quotes, liberal Republican during like that first term.
Yep.
And then he was something like the third or fourth most conservative during the second Bush term.
And
like
and
no one had made the transformation this guy made, and he did it all because of his interest. And I'll just the last thing quickly. I know you want to jump in. And the way you've seen him personally go after Obama and turn it into a grudge match and be bitter is because, again, this is who he is. He's never forgiven Obama for beating the great John McCain. He can't handle it. He's never lived up to the legacy of his father and grandfather that were famous admirals and were actually very well respected in the military for what they accomplished. And so he still sort of hates Obama for robbing him of his legacy. And
now,
that's
it seems
where a lot
to me,
of this comes from.
It seems to me this whole Benghazi thing with John McCain is all about him saying there is a vacuum of leadership in the Republican Party right now, and I am now going to go back to being the titular head of the Republican Party. Now that we're past the election, so he comes out. He says he starts saying all sorts of talking smack about Susan Rice, the ambassador to the United Nations. He is convinced there is some type of massive Benghazi scandal, Benghazi gate that's going
right
on. And so in all – this is fantastic. I think people are aware of this. So the other day there is a hearing. There's testimony on Benghazi
right,
talking to – I don't know exactly which one he didn't go to. If it was one with Petraeus in there, but it was a big deal, particularly if you're trying to push that there's some type of Benghazi gate, and he skips it. He doesn't even go to it. And so he is
right
asked, we have the audio, he is asked by the by CNN, why didn't you go to it? The audio is not great, but he loses it. And I wanted you, Cliff, to listen to this and comment on this audio because, of course, you wrote The Real McCain. Here is the audio. John McCain really showing his crusty old man side and just the entitlement here. I can crap all over. I can say that there's a huge Benghazi scandal, but go to the hearing on Benghazi? Why would I do that?
He's too busy going on TV.
Investigate it all. Well, our Ted Barrett caught up with the senator earlier today and wanted to know why he didn't go to that briefing. And to say the least, it did not go well. Listen to what happened.
Who the hell are you to tell me where I can or not?
And I'm giving you an answer for the
10th
time.
Who the hell are you to tell me that I'm a senator?
I know.
Who are you telling me I have to go to the Benghazi?
Little whiny voiced, you know, that's classic McCain. I mean, because again, he's so privileged. How dare you ask him? That's the guy that that called his wife the four-letter word. That's the guy that, like, assaulted and physically jumped on a congressman after he was mocking him and has pretty much told half of his own caucus to go F themselves to the point where everybody hates him.
Now, so let me ask you this, though. I just don't understand how the guy thinks he can get away with this. And do you think, and there's been, I feel like there's been other times, but do you think this is the beginning of the end of people's love affair with John McCain? Because look, he's, can he possibly have any more relevance? I mean, I just, nobody really trusts him in the Republican Party. I just don't understand. And he is chasing after this stuff just to get into the limelight. I mean, honestly, this Benghazi.
It's disgraceful is what it is.
Do you think the press is still going to shower this guy with affection?
I do, because, it's sort of looking at, look, I mean, he was so wrong about Iraq, and it had such deadly consequences. Where was his big calling for an investigation of that? Where was his making sure they went beyond, not that there weren't investigations, but we all know what went on under the Bush administration and a Republican Senate. You know, where was where was John McCain pushing to the ends of the earth to find out what went on with those WMD that were never there? Where was John McCain pushing when, you know, four people, and it was tragic, were killed in Benghazi, including a U.S. ambassador? What about 3,000 people that were killed, you know, on September 11th? And as it's come out in what's his name, Kurt, I can't think of his last name, his book, you know, the number of warnings that these guys had that we didn't even previously know about, probably 40 different warnings at different times, making it very clear that something was coming, and some of them even had some of the information as guys are taking going to flight schools quite openly and trying to learn how to fly planes, but not land them or take them off, just steer them. You know, where was the investigation of that? Where's the investigation of Condoleezza Rice and the fact that he and little Lindsey Graham supported Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State? Remember, she of the mushroom cloud? She of talking about how, much like Mitt Romney, these guys never changed, it's funny, how Russia would be our number one concern back in 2000, 2001, and terrorism wasn't something that, you know, they set our hair on fire and worry about as these guys were planning to attack us and murder Americans. If there was anybody who should have been disqualified by their idiocy from ever moving on from the position that she held and should have been run out of government, it should have been Condoleezza Rice. And it certainly should have been the Bush administration. But there was no John McCain there screaming and yelling about that. You know, that was okay.
I think this
okay.
is just because he's pissed that he's not going to be defense secretary. I mean, honestly believe like he's like,
oh,
he's
you're right. Everything is about him. It always is.
I mean, this is like classic, you know, this is the stuff I deal with my 7-year-old daughter. You know, it's like, I think he's like, I'm not going to be defense secretary. So no one is going to be defense secretary. No one.
And God forbid, you know, an African-American woman be defense secretary who potentially instead of him. Although I think they're talking more about her, Susan Rice, for Secretary of State. But still, right. Nonetheless, there's always been, I mean, the guy's 112 years old, and some of the things he said were beyond borderline racist. I think there's race in this. I mean, let's ask ourselves questions. Why is it that all the people that always get so viciously attacked in the Obama administration are African American? You ever wonder that one?
Well, that's because they're
Barack
all socialists.
Obama, Shirley Sherrod, Van Jones, Eric Holder. I mean, there's certainly reasons I haven't liked President Obama and Eric Holder, but they've generally had to do with policy, haven't they?
Right.
I can say they always have. I mean, why is it? Why is it always the black, the African American members who are being attacked like us?
Well, I think, to be fair, Cass Sunstein, I think, was on Glenn Beck's board for a while.
Okay, I'm just saying, you know, and it's not to say there never was anybody, but I think we'd be blind to not think that there's some race in this. That there's some sexism in this.
I think for McCain, I think it's just his petulance, and I'm going to credit him with having this sense of propriety and this petulance, regardless of the race of the person. But Cliff, we've run out of time, buddy.
Well, darn it!
We're going to
here we go talking all of our time again, Sam.
Well, couple things. Want to just say. Have a happy Thanksgiving. We will obviously not having a live show next Friday. So I want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving. And
you too, man.
Again, thank you for your enormous participation and making the show a success over the past 2 years. I don't know. We should find out exactly when your anniversary is, but it's pretty darn close as far as I can tell.
I think – well, we can figure it out because it was one of the conferences. First time, like, you kind of had me on for our Friday segment, and we said, hey, that was fun. We should do that every time.
Yeah,
so it's which conference? It was one of the ones in Vegas, and I just don't remember which one right now.
I have no idea. I think it was the, I don't know. It was either the Gadget Conference or the, no, we'll look it up. But Cliff, thanks again. Appreciate it, buddy. And
all right, thanks.
We'll talk to you in a couple
weeks.
And
you have a great Thanksgiving too, pal.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Marc Maron. He's going to give us a movie selection for the week and that and more in just one moment. We'll be right back. Mind. You're selling out women, you love to All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone, possibly still swearing. Mark Maron. Mark, hello, Mark.
Hi, Sam.
How are you? Why were you swearing? That was like the old days when I, you know.
I'm in a panic, Sam.
You're in a what?
I'm in a panic.
Oh, okay. Why?
Because, I just got caught up with some stuff here, and it's all very important stuff.
What is, you got a problem, like, with the T-shirts, or you can't find the coffee, or some self-portrait fell off the wall? What is it?
I've become obsessed with my records. I went out and bought this equipment so I could play my crappy old records, and now I've gone into this rabbit hole of records and cleaning records. And, like, I've got a lot of things to do, Sam, and now I'm trying to decide whether or not to keep a Frank Sinatra album. It's stupid because I don't even like Frank Sinatra necessarily, but I had the record. I don't know where I got the record from. I was very thrilled to find that I had a fairly pristine Woodstock set that I'm not going to listen to. So it's not even about listening to the records now. It's about judging the records I have and then going to record stores and trading some in and getting new records. I'm in high school, Sam, is what I'm trying to say. I'm in high school.
I was going to say, like, how does it feel to have that set of problems? Like, I just like, you know, the idea, the luxury to have.
Let me tell you something. Oh, let me tell you something. It's interesting of you to condescend like that. But what I'd like to point out is that these are not problems. I just taped, my show. I have a little bit of downtime. I have things I need to do. And sometimes when I get obsessed about something, it sort of grounds me. It stops me from spiraling into a malignant thought pattern. So I'd like to think of it as proactive as opposed to luxury problems.
So you're saying actually that your obsession and spiraling into a panic over whether or not to keep an album that you don't like actually keeps you from spiraling into a panic and worrying about just other things.
Yeah, about death, disease, my age, whether or not I'm going to have children, is my show good? Am I still funny? The real stuff.
Right.
So, don't knock it. Find yourself an obsession to nerd out about and give yourself a break.
Well, I do that. That's what I do with politics.
Yeah, I know. I wish I could still do that, but that causes me a lot of aggravation.
Yeah, no, I understand. Believe me. Now, I understand. Okay, now, Mark.
Yeah.
My understanding is that Ed Asner got fed up with you and stormed off the set of your show, and so you had to get a new father on your let me back up for a minute. You got a show on IFC. You taped it, right?
We just finished taping 10 episodes of a single-camera, half-hour scripted comedy thing based on my life, and we're now in the editing process. Yeah, we recast. Ed Asner didn't get fed up with me. I think he might be fed up with things in general. But by the time we got down to casting, he was in a play, and it all becomes very immediate once you start shooting. It's like we need somebody next week and that kind of thing. So it was really just about scheduling, I think.
I got to say, so who's your dad now? I think this is actually, to be honest with you, I like it. I like the choice.
Yeah, Judd Hirsch is my father, and it was a good choice. It was interesting working with him because my father's, a bit of a angry, kind of dark guy, and that's not what you think of Judd Hirsch. You think of Judd Hirsch as sort of like cute and Jewy, and I needed frightening and Jewy, or sort of a hybrid of cute and frightening Jewy. And he was great. We actually edited that episode, and it was very compelling. And he looks like he could be my father. He looks like my father. I don't really know if my real father is going to be happy with this whole thing, but I'm just figuring since he hasn't figured out how to listen to my podcast yet, maybe he doesn't have cable.
Yeah.
I think I can hide the show from my father.
Wait, now does Judd Hirsch, is he your dad in every episode?
No. When you shoot on the budget we were shooting on, which was low, the way it generally works.
What's the budget of the show?
I don't know. But it's not my job to know that.
Of course you know it.
But if you use, you can't really have an ensemble cast because that gets into a very pricey world. So, when I have recurring guests, like he's in, he's in two episodes as my father. And there's a couple of other recurring roles that are three episodes. But, you know, no one's in all the episodes except for me, which made it a fairly exhausting shooting process.
Now, I'm not quite clear on how this is going to work. You've already finished shooting them, but when do I make my appearance? How do you do that? With CGI, or how does that work?
Well, I mean, the hope was, Sam, that we get another season, and then you know, I could bring you in.
Really?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about you know that our dynamic chemistry that is capable of syncing a series, you know, within probably three episodes, was really sought after. You know, a lot of people in the business say, "Hey, didn't you and Sam destroy something together?" And I'm like, "Well, it was mostly him." And they're like, "Yeah, but we love it." So we wanted to save that magic for season two.
Well, that's it's good to hear that you're strategizing about it. Now, what is this? I saw you tweeted out a picture with you lying in bed with Gina Gershon. Were there any charges involved in that, or that actually was that planned?
Well, she actually charged me with being incredibly sexy and smelling nice. So, I mean,
really?
Is that what you mean, or you mean?
So, what are you not wearing a patchouli, or what?
I always wear patchouli. Gina Gershon was in one episode playing a woman that an age-appropriate woman that I date, and that goes a little differently than I would have hoped. But she was great. She was really sweet and a real pro, and it was very interesting.
Now, what do you mean by
work with her?
The tension is because you're dating someone who's age appropriate to you.
What now?
I'm asking, like, from a dramatic standpoint, is the tension because she's age appropriate?
No, there was no tension. It was just there's sort of a surprise, relative to her. To her situation in life, and I don't want to give too much because, you know, why spoil it, you know, like 8 months
now. I saw
down.
This. It's the crying
but, like,
game.
She wasn't what I thought she was, is what it turns out to. But the funniest thing about working with Gershon is she had to, you know, make a pass at me. And so we had to sort of...
She's a brilliant
she had
actress.
To take the, huh?
She's a brilliant actress.
Yeah, she had to take the initiative, you know, sexually with me, and we were trying to do this scene, and she literally said, like, you know, I never do this in real life. I never... make the first move, and I thought, like, have you watched any of your movies? This is really a struggle for you to be the dominant partner in this situation.
Were you thinking when she said that? Were you thinking that's ironic because this is the first time I've never not made the first move?
I don't consider what I do first move. I consider it a mutual event.
Really.
Well, maybe, okay, that's, you know, I'm being too diplomatic about myself.
So who else
no,
is on the show?
Course.
So she played, who else? Who else would we whose name?
Well, okay. Well, a lot of people, you know, played themselves because one of the elements of the show is the podcast. So, you know, some people play themselves, you know, just, you know, as podcast guests for a couple minutes. Or
oh, well, that explains why I wasn't called in.
Dude, like, you know, quite honestly, you know, hopefully we'll do more. And I'll say it publicly. I'd more than love to have you on an episode of it.
What makes you think this is public?
I thought you had listeners. Aren't I talking to anybody but you and a giggling woman in the back? Who is that, by the way?
That is my producer, Matt, and my other producer, Michael.
You got two producers over there. All right, so that's two people. I'm glad someone's enjoying the show.
You know what Myla said, actually? I don't know why, but you and Myla, the only people who said this, Myla came in to visit me, and she was leaving, so she looked at Matt and Michael, and she goes, she said, "See you later, ladies."
What? What'd she say?
She looked at Matt and Michael and said, "So long, ladies."
I didn't hear him. But so there's an element of the show. No, I think it would be fun to do one with you, and we can. Let's just see what happens.
I mean, who else?
Like
who else?
Huh?
Who?
Oh, well, the podcast guests, let's see. Some of them were just, you know, on for a few minutes doing the podcast, and some of them had bigger roles. It was Dave Foley. Mm-hmm. And he played a big part throughout the episode. And also we had Adam Scott, Aubrey Plaza,
don't
Mark Duplass.
Don't know those people.
Jeff Garland. Ileana Douglas, Dennis Leary,
yeah.
Bobby Slayton, and I think I'm missing one.
Sounds like a huge bill of Chuckle Huts.
Yeah. Eric Stoltz played a character in one of the shows, and who else acted in it? It was all pretty exciting. It was something I never thought would happen for me, and you know, it was fun.
Yeah, it is pretty shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is, Sam. You know, given how many opportunities you had and screwed up, the fact that I hadn't been given one was always profoundly disturbing.
Wait, what do you mean you haven't been given one? What are you talking about? What about that the short attention span theater?
Yeah, what about that?
Well, that was an opportunity. And what about never mind the Buzzcocks or something like that, or?
Yeah, those are good ones. Yeah, those two.
Well, what are you trying
I'm sorry
to...
those two didn't pan out.
Well, I mean, come on now. This is a.
I never got to do like a narrative television show or whatever you want to call it. Like I've had deals before where I've written pilot scripts. I've never been able. I never was able to act or actually do like a show or attend. Certainly it was.
So when can I start to see these? When can we see them?
They're slated for June.
June?
I know. I don't know what to do about it, dude. It's just the way it is.
That's fine.
To do with
good. That's the way it works on cable.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. There doesn't seem to be a fight there that I can get involved with or win. But they've been great. IFC was very great. It was a good experience. I just hope people dig the show. And I just have no idea. I'm trying not to. As I said, to avoid a pit of insecurity and dread, I think I'm going to sell this Frank Sinatra record.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I would definitely do that. But let me ask you this. Can you send me digital copies of the shows as they get cut and we can just include them as like a bonus for members? Or is that not?
What are you, out of your mind? You think that I would send you anything in the sort of like raw process where you think I would show you anything where there was still work to be done on it? I mean, that would be, I might as well put a bullet in my head.
Come on. Wow. You've gotten much darker since the last time we spoke.
Yeah. I'll send you each episode as we edit it for notes. Would that be good?
That's fine. Maybe we can get some type of fiber optic situation where as soon as it gets into the Avid or the Final Cut Pro, I'm looking at it in real time. I don't mind sitting down with your editor a little bit.
I couldn't think of a better way for us to sort of reconnect on a day-to-day basis.
Did you shoot it in your house?
No, man. They... we shot it all in my neighborhood, but they actually, my house is not conducive. It's too small and cluttered. But they rented a house like a half a mile from here, and they kind of they built my house within this house. Like they built a set for the garage based on my garage, and they built an interior of the house based on my house. It looked a lot better than my house. It was a little disturbing because it was in my style, but it was so much more stuff and so much nicer looking. I think I inappropriately asked the decorator to do my home, but that's not going to happen.
Did they have to spend, how much did they have to spend on all the pictures of you, like the painted pictures of you? That was the one thing I noticed when I went to your house. I thought it was a lovely house. The garage is actually really well set up. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I really was just, it sometimes it keeps me up at night. How many pictures of yourself, like paintings and collages?
Well, the hardest thing about, the dozens of paintings and pictures I have in my house that adoring fans do for me, that I inspire that in them. I'm sorry that you get that kind of, whatever, we're doing a different thing. So, it was very difficult to recreate those and also to get permission from some of the artists to use them. But we did pull back on that. I had the discussion with the set director. I said, this is ridiculous. There's only 9 pictures of me in my house. It's really not authentic. And she, convinced me that we should put other artwork up. So, we made a compromise.
Oh, excellent. Well, she was smart. I like it.
Yeah.
So what do you do now? It's just... I told you
I'm cleaning records. I mean, I don't know how clear I have to be about what's going on in my life right now.
Oh, gosh. Well, all right. Now, Mark, let me remind folks here that every weekend, every Friday, we have somebody on to give me a streaming movie recommendation. Because as you know, Mark, I am married and I have a child. And I'm not allowed to leave the house to go out and do anything social, certainly not go see a movie, because that would be a full almost 90 to 120 minutes when I'm not around the house doing something for my wife or my daughter. And so I have to the best I can do is watch something on Netflix or Amazon streaming, or I guess now my Roku has Vudu. You know, and then I get to watch it and I have to stop it every 5 or 10 minutes because of whatever is being required of me at the time. So, you got any suggestions?
Well, I watched something recently. I don't do it a lot, but I don't know if this is on Netflix, but I just watched that documentary on Warren Zevon. I think that was like an hour long. I think it was a VH1 documentary, when he found out he had cancer in about that last year of his life. That was pretty interesting because I don't know a lot about him. But I think the most recent thing I watched on Netflix was it was a documentary about the Dr. Bronner's all-in-one soap. Have you seen that? You're hippie enough to know what that looks like, right? The all-in-one. Have you ever sat in the bathroom holding a bottle of Dr. Bronner's, reading that label?
Yeah,
and thinking about things.
Yeah, I mean, back in the days when we were living in San Fran. That was basically it. I mean, I think I seem to recall not only washing with that, but that was like one or two meals a day I would have until you and your first wife would invite me over for dinner.
So you were eating the soap. You were eating it?
I think you were drinking it. Isn't it liquid?
Yeah. I think, that's the amazing thing about it. You can do anything with it. You can eat it. You can drink it. You can, do enemas with it. It's an all in one thing, but here's the interesting thing is that, Dr. Bronner's son, he has a son that was sort of touring the country a little bit. He was a little off and he does sort of a one man show about his father and he's spreading the word of Dr. Bronner's. And this guy, Dr. Bronner, was this interesting guy. He was like, I believe, a Holocaust survivor or got out right before. And he comes from a family of soap makers and he started making this soap. And he's this sort of manic, peculiar man who was blind. And like in the late 60s, because there was such a search for spiritual kind of connectivity, like he sort of rode this wave of the original New Agers into this preeminent role as this kind of, he spoke, he lectured. He's a very odd character, and it was a very interesting little doc. So I would recommend that. I forget what it's called. I think it's called Dr. Bronner's Magic Soap or something like that.
Hold on. I'm going to look it up. Dr. Bronner's Soap Documentary. Magic Soapbox, is that what it is?
What is it?
Dr. Bronner's Magic Soapbox?
Yeah, that sounds like it.
Interesting. Yeah,
it's kind of fun, because you really see a guy who had a vision and he was completely obsessed with his soap and it became almost like a religion to him, and clearly like almost a religious kind of ritual for a lot of other people. I mean, I still use it, and there's plenty of people who are probably eating quinoa and living a different life than me.
You know what that always reminded me of? Didn't he have the label has like just tons and tons of writing on it, right? I mean, it just like goes on. Do you remember, we don't see this as much anymore, and I'm not sure quite why. Maybe it's because we're in the digital age. But it used to be, and certainly in San Francisco, we were out there. Longtime listeners will know that I had an internship with you in San Francisco in 1992, I think it was. Maybe 20 years ago now, almost to the day,
right?
Probably, where I was. I would follow you around to coffee shops and watch you go on caffeine and tobacco binges and purges. And then follow you to comedy clubs. And one thing I remember about that, I was living on Valencia. I think you were living on Mission. And
South Van Ness. I was on South Van Ness, and you were living in like a closet, I think a lesbian's closet. And you had a chair and a typewriter. And I still had that chair for the longest time because you make it sound like, you know, you were doing me a lot of favors, but no one really liked you and you had no friends. And we used to have you over for dinner so you would eat and talk about your life. And I believe my first wife introduced you to a woman that you actually dated sort of happily for a little while. So let's just balance it out.
Yeah, no, I did. That's true. Your first wife did introduce me. I remember her. She was quite nice, actually. And maybe we can talk afterwards about where she is today. I mean, because fortunately...
My first wife, she's a family therapist.
No, I'm not talking about... I'm talking about that other girl.
Oh, the other girl. Yeah, I don't know. Do you know where she is?
No, I have no idea.
I don't either.
But I do remember there was a lot of guys who would mimeograph papers, the flyers that they would give you, and they would write on every square, every centimeter of that paper.
Right.
In the smallest
of
writing.
Those are called schizophrenics.
Yes. And it sounds like maybe Bronner, I always thought that that was sort of, there was something ironic about how much they put on those labels. Maybe it was, maybe the guy was just, he wouldn't stop writing on it.
He's an interesting guy. Watch the documentary. That's a good departure point for curiosity. I've got to meet my friend Steve for coffee now. Can I go or are we good?
Yeah, no, we're good.
Yeah, I didn't mean to be abrupt. I'm just in a coffee shop now, and now I'm putting on a show.
No, I got the movie selection. That's all I really wanted out of this.
No, you wanted a lot more, and I love you, Sam, and everybody loves you, so just relax.
Well, that's very sweet, Mark. Yeah, well, right back at you, and let's talk about this whole editing gig.
Okay, yeah, I'll be in touch with you, you know, soon.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Mark,
yeah,
Maron,
I mean, you know, don't wait by the phone. You know, give me a month.
A month? Are you really gonna wait?
It'll happen. Just, you know, say hi to Milo and be careful.
Okay. I will. You too, buddy.
All right.
Good luck with your records.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks.
All right, folks. Now we're going to head into the better half of the program, where and I will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. And we have audio now from Mitt Romney's petulant fit. I don't know if we'll play it. We probably will, but I don't know. I'm so tired of that dude already. We can talk about the best thing on the web these days, apparently, is Matt's Tumblr that he set up. What's it called?
It's publicshaming.tumblr.com.
Folks should check this out. I tweeted it out last night. It was one of my most successful tweets ever. And I think it was really more of a function of this. Matt collected all of these tweets from conservatives, mostly young people, who were saying stuff like, people on welfare, they're fat and lazy. And then he would just go a little bit deeper into their feed and find where they're going, like, got up at 11 a.m. this morning. I really should get a job, but I'm so hungover. Stuff like that. We'll put a link to it on the site. You should check this out. I have to say, I found it extremely gratifying. But we'll take your phone calls, your IMs on the other side of the program. 646-257-3920. Again, folks, your support makes this program possible. I'm not Mark Maron, okay? Well, I don't get huge advertising buys. I don't, people aren't sending me records or whatever it is, and I'm not doing pilots with Judd Hirsch or getting to lie down in bed with Gina Gershon half naked. Which is not to say that I would want to in the impossible likelihood that Nikki is listening to the show. But I'm just saying, generically speaking, we rely on your largesse. And I think I mentioned this yesterday. This is the way this stuff is going to go. We've got we're losing progressive talk on the airwaves because it just doesn't fit into the formula that Clear Channel has set up. And as that business contracts, more of this is going to go online, and you can position this show in such a way that we can have a future.
So please support the show by becoming a member. You can also buy your Amazon crap at our Amazon link, majority.fm/support the show. Click on the button, bookmark it, and bookmark it and always buy your Amazon crap. You won't know the difference, but we will. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. We've got merch if you want to buy merch. You can donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. Like our stuff on Facebook. Sign up and subscribe to our YouTube channel, for gosh sakes. If you're one of those people who do the YouTubes. All right, see you in the better half. We got that Jimmy Reefer Cake song. God, I got to do everything?
Well, you forgot about it. You forgot about it, too.
I know. But that's what I'm saying. Do I got to do everything? You got to host the show? Got to cue the music? All right. Jimmy Reefer Cake sends us an email. Jimmy, I'm sorry.
Give me a second.
You get out of a habit, and you know how it is. But he writes, it was a little over 2 years ago when I bumped out yet another PC and one of my old spare ones. Fate works in strange ways. I fired up the old gateway and clicked on an old bookmark for the Majority Report. The next thing I know, I'm listening to your soft launch and launch laughing my ass off. A big fan of you. I hadn't listened since your Air America morning show. And yes, I sang you a song during your last hour of airtime. Oh, wow. As I listened each day to your relaunch, I noticed that for some reason you were not covering what I consider a fundamental issue for any true progressive. Seemed like you were oblivious to the battle to end marijuana prohibition. Fast forward today, and you actually do a pretty decent job of covering the battle and end reefer madness. Interviews with Michelle Alexander, and was it Ryan Grimm the other day who said he was the Nate Silver of pot? At least a couple others really delved into it. I like to think my gently sarcastic prodding over the last couple of years helped you stay on the ball. But most of all, I want to thank you and encourage you to keep up the good work. You don't have to smoke it to find it fascinating how the government has blundered so badly and what this means in the big picture. Congrats. And here's a song written in response to that F.O. who IM'd about me the other day. Here's the song.
So you say that I'm forgetful, as if that's some kind of crime. You say weed is a frat boy drug. You sound so superior. You simple-minded dimwit. You think I am inferior, but I'm doing fine. I'm smoking kind. It won't blow my mind. I'm doing fine. You got no sense. You're freaking dense. I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. You think the government is the answer, huh? But that's only true when it does things right. Did you know marijuana can help cure cancer? And you still don't understand the fight. What? Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I'm smoking kind. Won't blow my mind. You got no sense. You're freaking dense. I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine.
Jimmy Reefer Cake. Search on iTunes, Amazon, or eMusic.
Oh, bravo, bravo.
He's putting his own ads in the song.
He's tagging his own stuff now. I love it. There you go, folks. I think the one thing that we've really come to understand about the marijuana is it's all being pushed by entrepreneurs. So there you go. All right, folks, we'll see you in the better half.
Sage and apple pay.